Good morning and welcome to this November 18th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your host for just this hour, Marie Stone. I pre-recorded an interview with Colin McCann, and I'm going to play that now. And in the second half, John Freeman will join me to talk about the anthology he edited, Tale of Two Cities, The Best and Worst of Times in Today's New York. But first, my pre-recorded interview with Colin McCann. Colin McCann is the international best-selling author of the novels Transatlantic, Let the Great World Spin, Zoli, Dancer, This Side of Brightness, and Song Dogs, as well as two prior critically acclaimed short story collections. He was on the show with me back in 2010 for Let the Great World Spin, and in 2013 for Transatlantic. A podcast of both of those interviews are up on the web and available on our website. Check those out. His fiction has been published in 35 languages. He has received many honors, including the National Book Award, the International IMPAC Dublin Literary Award, a Chevalier, I can't speak French, but I'm going to try, the Chevalier de l'Arts and Letters Award from the French government, and the Ireland Fund of Monaco Literary Award in memory of Princess Grace. He's been named one of Esquire's best and brightest, and his short film Everything in This Country Must was nominated for an Oscar in 2005. He's a contributor to The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, The Paris Review. He teaches in the Hunter College MFA Creative Writing Program. He lives in New York. And he's the co-founder of the global nonprofit story exchange organization Narrative for, a wonderful organization. Hopefully we'll have time to chat about that a little bit. Check that out. His latest is a novella and three stories entitled 13 Ways of Looking. It's published by Random House, and we're going to chat about it this morning. Colin, welcome back.
Thank you so much. That's quite a list.
Quite a list, indeed. Quite a list, indeed.
You surprised me.
When you hear it, it's overwhelming, right? So you, you have been very lucky. You've been through so much since the last time we talked, and I'm so excited to have you back on, and extra happy to have you on with a collection of short stories, because everybody who listens to this show knows that I'm a huge fan of that form. So this is a treat all around. So you've been the writer of the expansive, sweeping novels, and your last short story collection came out in 2004. So talk a little bit about that, about returning to short stories again after more than a decade, and what caused you to go back to that form.
Well, I love the short story, and occasionally I've done a few short stories, and frankly, I know after Let the Great World Spin and Transatlantic, I was a little exhausted, and I thought, okay, it's time to take some sort of a different form of exercise. I often talk about writing as being like a writer must be like an athlete. Certainly, in my classes, I tell the students you have to think like an athlete. You have to work and hone your craft and put the time in and be there. For me, I was after those two novels, I wanted to change up the temperature. It's almost like switching teams for a little while or moving a dress. And I love the short story, and I worked on many of them. In fact, I ended up writing 13 of them, and the book is called 13 Ways of Looking, but in the end I went with four because I thought the four sort of link together thematically. And I've always thought the novel is like an exploding universe. It goes in several different directions, and it sends off its shrapnel in all directions. Whereas a short story is more like an imploding universe, and it's sort of much tighter and denser. But they're both, in the end, they are both universes, and neither one is more valid than the other. And I think that's the important thing about short stories.
I like that. And the four of these they're very different from each other, but they're also in conversation with each other, which I think is really interesting. So talk a little bit, for the people that haven't picked the book up yet, sort of the scope of the four, and what you were thinking about thematically when you were writing.
Well, there's a novella, which is 13 Ways of Looking, which comes after the 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, the poem by Wallace Stevens. Mm-hmm. And that is about a retired judge in Manhattan who gets sort of randomly punched in the chest on a snowy afternoon. And he is seen by surveillance cameras, and his last day is seen by various angles throughout the city. So it's a novella about it's about surveillance, it's about poetry, it's about language, it's about memory, and there's a certain element of the detective story about it too. Though the detectives are only video detectives, and they remain sort of aloof from the story. Another story is called Shekol, which is a Hebrew word for a parent who has lost a child. It can be a noun or adjective. We don't have a word in English for a specific word in English for a parent who has lost a child. We have widows and widowers and orphans and so on, but we don't have that particular word. And that's about a child in the west of growing up in the west of Ireland who goes missing. And then I have a story about an Irish nun, a radical Irish nun who recognizes her attacker 37 years after she has been in Central America. And then the last one is about, a writer who invents a story about a female Marine who is in Afghanistan. It's more an investigation of the process of writing. And all of these are sort of specifically related to trauma and recovery and forgiveness and all of these things. And much of it emanated from the fact that last year, while I was writing these stories, in fact, three quarters of the way into the book, I was in a very unfortunate incident in New Haven, Connecticut, where I was sort of attacked in the street and suffered sort of, some pretty severe injuries from which I am now thankfully recovered. And so in many ways the book is dealing with the aftermath of when, I suppose, reality met fiction and fiction preceded reality.
Right, right. I was out in the desert last year on a writing retreat, actually with the main host of this show, when I learned about that attack. And, you know, we've only talked a few times, we've never met. And yet being so distant from you, but familiar with your writing, it still felt personal. I mean, it was this weird, you know, like your writing. The specific became very universal. And there were all of these weird prescient things. I'd heard an interview you had done back in 2013 when we talked about Transatlantic. And I think it was the National Writers Series. And somewhere during the course of that interview, you said, you know, maybe I should get into a fist fight, you know, all of, you know, the writers back in the 50s. And maybe that's what I need. And and I know you were writing a lot of these stories preceding this. And I started thinking about, as you said, fiction is sort of a prologue to your own life, and how that event must have seeped into these stories.
So yeah, it was a rather bizarre thing to be three quarters of the way through a novella and then have this attack happen to me. You know, and maybe I learned from it, and maybe I didn't. But the fact of the matter is that the reason I spoke up about it was because the man who attacked me had attacked a woman in the street, and I had intervened, and I had solved the whole thing. He came back later and attacked me from behind in the most cowardly way. But I think, writing was cathartic. It was a chance for me to tell the story. And in fact, I got to write a victim impact statement for the courts who were sentencing the attacker. And in that way, just the very nature of telling the story, or being allowed to tell the story, being given space to do it, gave me a chance to reclaim my territory. And I think that's the function and essence of literature, is that we can reclaim our territory, no matter how small or anonymous it seems to be. These stories eventually matter. I'm reminded of the Algerian poet Tahir Dajoud, who says beautifully, he says, if you keep quiet, you die. If you speak, you die. So speak and die.
I like that. Do you feel like you see the world differently after it? Do you approach things differently? Do you approach writing differently?
No. I mean, for a while I was scared. For a while I was depressed. For a while I was not engaging. I wasn't writing. But I sort of got out of that because I was able to see the value of this strange thing that we all do, which is like putting the pen against the paper and seeing what sort of shape emerges from the most mysterious parts of our brains.
Yeah. And you had talked about what a great, I think it was Let the Great World Spin, that some high school students in the aftermath of a school shooting had used as sort of a cathartic way for them to deal with what they'd gone through, and sort of the redemptive power of fiction, you know, how you can use it, even if it's not mapped onto whatever experience you're going through, to help you through some circumstance. And you had talked about that for your readers, and then to go through it as a writer, I think would also be really very interesting.
Yeah, that was in Newtown High School. I went up to Newtown High School after the shootings there, and one of the teachers there, Lee Keelock, used Let the Great World Spin as a way for the kids to negotiate grief and recovery. And we also ran the Narrative 4 program there, and that's the international story exchange that and many other artists and activists have been at the forefront of for the last few years, where we get kids from different parts of the world to step into one another's shoes and to tell one another's stories, which is it's a really wonderful project, and anybody who's interested in it can actually go on to narrative4.com and see what it is that we're doing with the really powerful tool of storytelling.
Yeah.
I think it's important to acknowledge that stories can be dangerous too, and stories can be unsettling, and stories as well as being cathartic.
Right. Yeah, you had always said that it was more difficult to be an optimist than it was to be cynical, and I think you said that actually before you've been through all of this, and I think that's true. It is hard to see the optimistic side of life.
Cynics bore the pants off me. I mean, they're just, you know, like, you know, I'm just there and thinking, you know, I can be just as cynical as you. It's easy to be cynical. What's much more difficult and much more muscular is the ability to acknowledge the really nasty parts of the world, to acknowledge the darkness, and then step away from it and find something new and go to a different place. I think that's the sort of writing I like. And in fact, if you look at most writers of substance, so if you look at, say, the Nobel Prize speeches for the past 50 years, all the way back from Faulkner, Steinbeck, and even, you know, Harold Pinter and Toni Morrison and all these people, they all talk about the way that literature engages with the world and the proper place we have for discovering who we are as human beings. And so there's something, there's always something redemptive, I feel, even in the darkest corners. Maybe even just the act of finding out what's in the darkest corners is in itself a redemptive act.
Yeah, right. And you've got a lot of humor in here. I mean, the title story, you have this great character who's, as you said, he's a retired judge who's sort of, you know, at the end of life, dealing with all end of life stuff. And he's really very funny. And he has I think he's hysterical. And he has this great play with words, which I assume you must love to do in life as well, is just play around with language and play with words. And what a fun character. I thought, What a great way to put your own, I mean, I he must have developed organically, but what a great way to put your own, you know, fun stuff into a character and just let him sail with it.
Yeah, he surprised me. I mean, he's Lithuanian born, spent a couple of years in Ireland, but, you know, he's a Supreme Court judge in Brooklyn, and You know, these are his last days. And he got saucy, and I kind of liked that. And he does a lot of puns, and he sees the world in an ironic sort of way. He was a fun character to work with, a real fun character to work with.
Had you always been as into poetry as you are now? I can't remember poetry being a big part of your writing in the past, but I could be wrong.
I believe that fiction writers should be reading more poetry. I've always believed that, and I believe that the poets should be reading more fiction. I've been a fan of poetry since I was a kid, and I was introduced to it in school in Dublin all those years ago, and became a fan of, first of all, Dylan Thomas, and then Hopkins, and the language poets, Heaney and Muldoon and the rest of them. And so it was a lot of fun to get a real chance to incorporate poetry, and of course to take the title from Wallace Stevens as well. Although Let the Great World Spin was taken from Tennyson, there's something in the poetry.
Right. And you even had a small little tip of your hat homage to Let the Great World Spin in the title story too. I mean, there was something right in the opening about the world spinning on its axis or something, and I thought all of that, that wordplay, even wordplay with yourself, was really fun.
Yeah. It was a fun thing to do. I saw that line afterwards and said, that wasn't conscious in any way, but I sort of said, oh, well, it's there, it came out of the character's head, I'm just going to leave it there. Yeah, he talks about the world spinning out of control, I think it is.
Right. It's so great. My guest this morning is Colm McCann. The book is 13 Ways of Looking. You'd said a long time ago that you were interested in video surveillance, and you kept trying to get at it in your fiction and not getting at it quite right. And so when I read this, I was like, well, you got it now.
Oh, that's nice. Well, thank you. I mean, part of the problem was that the technology is hard to grasp, and I'm a techno idiot. I got my first phone about less than a year ago, mobile phone, and I'm forever getting viruses on my computer and don't know how to save and oversave on things and stuff. For me to get into something technological like that was a little bit of a head wrecker, but in the end, I was happy enough. And then I consulted with some video forensic experts, and I think that's what, I mean, as a writer, you have to do that. You have to go to the experts and see what it is that they are saying in order to, you have to get it right. It's your responsibility to get it right.
Yeah. What fascinates you about that topic?
I don't know, that we're constantly there, that we're always being looked at, that we can piece together, certainly in a city, we could piece together the movements of one person using images, using mathematics, using vectors, the turning of corners and so on. But then also the mysterious points where things disappear, where the shadows are different in one from the other, where the timestamp is different. One of the things that frustrates video detectives is that sometimes the timestamp and daylight savings time hasn't been taken account for on one of the machines, or the time is off by a couple of minutes, and they have to match all these things together. It's a pretty intricate process to look at these videos and then to try and reconstruct the past. And in a way, that becomes a comment then on memory, because isn't that what we're always trying to do? We're trying to look back, take little pieces of what we know was there, or at least what we think was there, and then try to construct a narrative out of it.
Right. That's so great. You're the master of writing from the point of view of women. You always have been. I mean, I think Let the Great World Spin had so many, strong women in it, this book as well. And you're so good at it. And you've talked about how much easier it is for you to inhabit women's lives than men in characters. Can you say anything about that again, and how you get your women so right?
I don't know. I mean, I'm flattered that you say that I get them right. I don't know, because it's probably not best for me to sit on the Freudian couch and figure out why this is. If I knew why, I probably wouldn't be able to do it again. I remember somebody coming up to me and saying once, "You write really well about maps." I was like, "Oh, that's very interesting. Hmm. Yeah, I use maps here, maps there." After that, I was unable to write another map scene.
Right.
I better not do that with the women characters. But no, I mean, I do think that I like the complex emotional baggage, and I also like, traveling in a different form and discovering the world from somebody else's point of view.
Yeah. I was wondering if you had ever thought about writing from an aggressor's point of view, because all of these stories are told, sort of from, I don't want to use the word victim, but, all of these are told from a particular point of view that is not the aggressor. And I was wondering if there's any value in that you see to writing from that point of view.
Yeah, I have thought about it, but I think that can get dangerous in the sense that it might look as if you're endorsing it, and I think evil is banal, and evil is and for evil to occur, it really only has to happen once. For something good to occur, it has to happen over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. So I think that confronting the evil is probably more of a challenge and more complex than, just writing from the point of view of the aggressor. But now that you've said it, maybe it would be something absolutely to try and do next time around. Who knows?
And then we can talk about it in 3 years, see how it went.
Yeah, hopefully even 2 years.
2 years, right. Yeah, it's funny because the last time we talked, you had said, we were talking about some of your enduring themes, and you talked about being forever interested in the idea of faith. And then as I was reading these stories, the last one, the word faith is used right at the end. I said, that's still on your mind.
Yeah, so when I started writing that story, there was a lot of news about nuns and the clergy and the Catholic Church, and especially in Ireland, and they were getting a sort of hammering, and in many cases it was a well-deserved hammering that they were getting from the media. But everything seemed so one-dimensional, and I thought about, I know some people who are nuns who are doing really great work around the world. I mean, really great work in poor communities and in issues of social justice and so on. I thought, I'm going to try and write a story about a woman who is a sort of radical, a radical nun, who questions her own faith. I think that's one of the great themes of literature. It's like, what is your faith? What is it in, and how does it manifest itself then later on in the world?
Right. I wanted to just mention a couple of fascinating facts about you, because I find them fascinating that you do all of your writing in a closet. I'm thinking that I'm going to adopt that idea, because I think there's something about shutting out the rest of the world, and first of all, shutting off my internet would be the first step, but really kind of physically putting yourself back in the womb to get in touch with a lot of these people and a lot of these ideas and kind of shutting the world out, I think is maybe a really good technique for writers to keep their butt in the chair if they're kind of physically locked up in a closet.
Right.
So many of our listeners talk about having the difficulty of just keeping butt in chair to get the work done. And this strikes me as sort of a tangible physical way to restrain yourself
it was kind of a nice accident. I had a friend build an office desk for me, and it happened to be a wraparound desk that went around a cupboard or a closet, and I just said, okay, just shove the desk further in there to the back of the closet because I didn't know how it was going to work. And then I sort of sat there for on top of the desk with my feet stretched out in front of me, which is really not a good position to be in for hours and hours on end. Anybody, any chiropodist will tell you that. But for me, I found that being in that tiny, confined space sort of concentrated a lot of things for me. So I do my writing in the space. I do my editing out elsewhere. Sometimes I take my editing with me to the park or whatever it happens to be, or walk down the street and do it somewhere else apart from where the actual physical writing occurs.
That's kind of interesting. So the ideas are born in this womb-like space of the closet, and then you test them in the world to see if they maybe match up with, you know, meeting the outside world. That's a great metaphor, actually. I kind of like that.
I suppose that's very much what it is. It's created out of like some little dark space, some small dark space, and you hope that it gets bigger and bigger. And I think that's why we tell our stories and why we need to tell our stories as much as anything else.
Yeah, exactly. My guest is Colm McCann. We're drawing down on our time, which is painful for me to even say. But I had also read that Ulysses was one of your favorite books that you keep coming back to. In fact, I heard a great story that you had encouraged one of your close friends to read it, who unfortunately passed away. And so you read him just the naughty bits of Ulysses, which is actually the only part of Ulysses I think I've read, or the fast forward to the naughty bits.
Yeah, when he died, I was in Fairview in Dublin with him in the funeral home, and it was about an hour or two before anybody was due to come visit him, and I was just like sitting there, and his partner Liz had put a copy of Ulysses on his chest to take with him, on the long journey to wherever, and so I just decided to crack it open and sat by the coffin and read him the naughtiest parts of Molly's soliloquy. So to send him off with a good smile on his face. But that's the greatest novel of the 20th century, if not the greatest novel of all time. It's such a complex, difficult, beautiful journey. But part of its beauty is its complexity and its refusal to make things easy on the reader. I think we live in a culture where far too much time is spent, being easy on the reader.
Right. I agree with you. Last-minute words of wisdom or advice for writers, particularly on the short story form. I was kind of wondering if the short story, do you think, is what the memoir was 5 years ago, where it's enjoying this really wonderful renaissance, and it seems like a lot of novelists are returning to the short story form. I see so many wonderful collections out there. Advice for writers in general, or any words that you have on the short story form are always welcome.
Yeah. Well, obviously, read, but read also aloud. I think it's very important for younger writers to risk the mockery of their spouses or their friends and walk around their apartments or whatever it happens to be and read it aloud. Read it for rhythm, because writing is music, Writing is texture. And if you can get the rhythm of the words, I guarantee you that you're gonna you're whispering in the reader's ear, come, listen to me. I have something to tell you. This is important. And this is the way it sounds. So read aloud and don't be afraid to fail. I mean, this is the other thing. It's kind of vivifying at many times to be able to say, hey, I took it on, I took a chance, it went wrong, went awry, but I at least tried something. Safety doesn't interest me whatsoever. So go for the bigger gesture, and you can always draw back later on. And read as much as you possibly can, reading your contemporaries, of course, but also going back into the classics and sometimes even imitating.
Yeah. Read outside your comfort zone, I keep hearing. Which Ulysses is a great place for most people to start to read outside their comfort zone. So that's the.
Well, if I were starting Ulysses, I would actually listen to it first. I'd probably have an actress like Aideen Maloney who would read Molly's soliloquy. And you know, it's a great it's a great scene. And when it's read aloud to you, you think, oh my word, that's amazing. And then you can go in and read it, and then that's the last chapter. But then you can go all the way to the first chapter and then, you know, delve in bits and pieces and until eventually it all sort of becomes a big fabric together. That's the way to discover a novel like Ulysses.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I always love talking to you. This was so great. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
I will. I'll look forward to our next time together in 2 years or sooner.
Absolutely. Hopefully about, we'll say 2 years, maybe three, maybe two.
We'll meet back here in 2.5 years.
Sounds fantastic. Hey, that's a date.
Okay, I'll keep it.
Thanks a million.
Thank you so much.
Cheers now.
Thanks for everything.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events. We are on Facebook. We are on Twitter. We are on Stitcher. There's no excuse not to be tuned in. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. John Freeman is the author of The Tyranny of Email and How to Read a Novelist. The former editor of Granta, he lives in New York and teaches at the New School in Columbia. He is the founder of the literary journal Freeman's, which just launched this past month. He served on the board of Housing Works from 1999 to 2008. Most interesting for our purposes today, John is the editor of an anthology of essays, Tales of Two Cities, The Best and Worst of Times in Today's New York. And a portion of the proceeds of the sale of this book will go to Housing Works. We will chat about that and more. John, welcome.
Thank you, Marie, for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on. This was an incredible, incredible book of essays. There's some poetry, short stories. It's got it all in here. And I want to give you a chance to sort of introduce the anthology, sort of where the idea came from for writing about New York and how the book came together.
Well, for a couple of years, I lived in London, and when I left Granta Magazine, I moved back to New York City. And I had been coming back every couple months, you know, to visit, and moving back was a different thing, because right away, the thing I noticed was just how inequality had become the defining characteristic of the city. So it was more expensive than ever, there was more places and restaurants to spend money than ever, and yet there were also more homeless people on the streets than ever. On my own block, I basically had to constantly navigate around street people, either sleeping or walking, asking for change. And I don't know where you're listening to this from, but imagine if every time you walked down to the end of your driveway, you had to step over someone to get there.
Yeah.
And that was my situation, and I live on a block where the average home price is over $1 million. So there's something very strange about that situation, and to make it even stranger, when I moved back, I didn't... My mother had died, and I'd come into an inheritance which allowed me to buy an apartment in my building. And at the same time, my younger brother was homeless in a shelter that was two blocks away. And he has a mental illness, and that's part of the reason why he was there. But the other reason why was he had wanted to live in New York City for most of his adult life and was tired of being told he couldn't because of how he is. So he just moved here and made himself homeless. And so I had a very intense reconnection with New York, and I looked around for books that possibly addressed the way New York felt today, and I found it very hard to find them. And I couldn't believe that the writers I knew who lived in New York or called it home hadn't been thinking about the same things I had, which were, how can we continue to live this way without morally compromising ourselves? And why does it never feel like the New York that I live in when I watch a movie or see a film or watch a TV show? Why do we always have to look at the New York of Sex and the City?
Right.
And so I talked to writers, and a lot of them said yes immediately, simply because they too had been thinking about it, but they just hadn't had, I think, yet an outlet for their storytelling generosity.
It's a great way to start a conversation about homelessness, which I think is just a tough topic to talk about. Your brother has a really wonderful essay in here about his perspective of being homeless, and in your introduction, of course, addresses it head on. Do you feel like this opened up a conversation between the two of you to be able to talk about it in a different way?
Well, I saw my brother when he was here, when I was living indoors and he was living at a shelter or out of doors. And he really wanted to do this on his own, and we would occasionally have meals and things together. But it was the disparity in our situations, which for me came down as well to sort of the disparity in our DNA, which is really why he is the way he is and the way I am. It's a complete and utter chance.
Yeah.
It was so much and so intense, I think I needed the distance from it to actually make sense of it. And for me, the making sense almost always involves writing. And I was, I wrote my introduction to this anthology, and then I decided the introduction in which I talk about Tim and the disparity in our life lives and how they've turned out. And I said, I won't publish this if you don't want me to. I understand why. He said, don't. And for about a day, I was really demoralized because I thought, this is my way into explaining why this matters to me, and also why the moniker Tales of Two Cities, or A Tale of Two Cities, which is how the mayor was talking about New York City in the run-up to his election, that New York City was a tale of two cities, that it was somehow a little bit off because it wasn't a tale of two cities. It was sort of a tale of one family, that the things that make people homeless are often beyond their control and often cut right through a family, so that you'll have someone who is homeless and have someone who's middle class or someone who you might consider rich.
Right.
And I thought without that kind of perspective in the book would be more agitprop than a kind of space for discussion. And so I went back to Tim and I said, what if you wrote your own story? And he wrote it very quickly in a day, and he's a writer himself, but he wrote a beautiful piece. And as an editor, I've been lucky enough to commission all kinds of people from, Kensborough OA to Doris Lessing and many other people in between, but this was by far the most rewarding commission I've ever had.
Yeah, so many of these essays, I mean, in addition to it being about wealth and income inequality, center around this issue of housing and finding a house and not having a house and looking for a place to live and how we live. And it seems like even if you have a lot of money in New York or, you know, middle class, housing is such an issue in New York and finding it and keeping it. And just talking about, you know, the ways we live, I think, are really interesting. And I haven't seen another book do that, certainly in this way.
Well, the New York living is difficult for everybody, even for the rich. It's less difficult, but everything that you think of as rather mundane, going to the store and getting groceries, is a bit of an ordeal here.
Yeah.
Because of the noise of the city, because of the crowds, because of, you know, you can't drive your car up to the parking lot. There's all kinds of things logistically that make it difficult to live here, and including among them, housing. It's very difficult to get good housing here, and it's especially difficult if you're middle class or if you're poor. And I think what the issue here is the political issue is income inequality. The larger issue, the human issue, is dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you live with dignity when you're struggling to that level? Your struggle gives you dignity, but I also think safety and shelter and the ability to take care of your family is the most important kind of dignity for many people,
right.
I would say. And with our current tenant laws, that makes it very difficult because landlords can really push tenants around quite a bit. And we see in this, there's a oral history in here about a woman who is living in Brooklyn. And many times, as you know, New York City has rent control. And if rent goes up above a certain level, then the apartment is no longer rent controlled, and then rent can be charged market value. And so when people buy buildings or want to get their tenants out of rent control, sometimes they, and in the case of the woman who gives her story in this book, sometimes the landlord just hires someone to to do a fake repair and then don't finish the repair. And so this woman in the book describes having a, you know, huge hole gashed through the middle of her apartment with no running water and bathroom, and it was left there for months.
Right.
And there's you know, I think I like to believe that most people are good and decent, but I actually, upon coming across this story, I thought this is the worst way to make money, because you have absolute clarity that the money and profit you're making is at the expense and through the pain of another person.
Through the real pain of someone else, yes.
Yeah, and a family, too, someone that's lived there for 10 years, that's been part of that neighborhood. And we often, I think, mistakenly talk about gentrification as if it's this sort of amorphous swarm, this kind of, you know, solvent green that's coming to attack us. But we're as instrumental to gentrification as it is part of our lives. And I think we need to look at the not just the causes of gentrification, but the instruments of it. And often those instruments are violent. It's a form of economic violence, and that's where I think political action can play a role. That it simply should not be legal to do this to people who live places.
Right, right. And, you know, with everything going on in the news right now, which I don't want to get into too much, but I don't see the situation improving in the next decade.
No, it's one of the we have a far more, I think, visionary mayor now than we did before, though Bloomberg was good at many things. Even if the mayor gets the kind of numbers of new public housing units built that he wants, there will still be a deficit in the city. There will still be a shortage.
Yeah, I imagine the number of people coming into New York and big cities is just going to, you know, be growing.
It's going to keep growing.
Yeah.
You know, and it's hopefully we can find a way to see this as a positive, because it is the strength of our cities. It's the strength, to my mind, of American literature, the fact that it is constantly getting blood transfusions from other cultures, that it's absorbing the sort of syntax and sounds of other languages. And it's what has made, I think, some of the great cities in this country so vibrant, so resilient, and so strong. And it's what built many of the cities, immigrant labor. I think if we can look at that as a positive, I think we're in much better vote than if we look at this as only a threat.
Yeah, indeed. So on your point of dignity, I wanted to bring up Colin McCann was on in the first half hour, and he had a lovely essay in here on treating someone with dignity in a different way to look at it. He talked about the tunnels under New York and befriending a homeless woman. And maybe you can talk just a little bit about his essay and relating it to your point about how to treat people with dignity.
Well, Colm's piece is very complicated, because he did something I think we all want to do, which is to try to help someone. If you encounter a street person, or if you see someone consistently who's homeless, and sometimes you have the instinct to help, and sometimes you respond to that instinct in yourself. And Colm was going underground to be researching his novel about the Sandhogs who built subway tunnels and tunnels under New York. And he kept running into this woman who was homeless. And he had been flying back and forth to Ireland, and he gave her some of the sort of moist packets that you get when you travel on international flights. And she was grateful for them. And so he took that gesture and then magnified it by many times by coming back with a huge bag of them. And he took what had been a kind of accidental interaction and turned it into an interaction that reminded her of her desperation, and she was offended. And it's a very delicate balance of how we are in the world, because our gestures don't just come as sort of neutral forces. They come with how someone perceives us, and they also come with our perception of the person that we're helping or interacting with. And nowhere, I think, is that are those dynamics as alive and complex as when we're reaching across a huge economic divide. I mean, this book isn't only about homelessness, but homelessness keeps coming up as a sort of as an orchestrating and sometimes radicalizing force within city life, because it is the most extreme version of disparity. You know, Colm, a middle class writer, with a job and all the comforts and that come with family, going underground to see someone who lives in a tunnel. How can they both acknowledge that they're human? And that's a question he asked very poignantly.
Yeah, yeah. My guest this morning is John Freeman. He is the editor of the anthology Tales of Two Cities, The Best and Worst Times of Today's New York. I want to talk a little bit about essay structuring and whatnot and your work at Freeman's and your work at the Housing Works. But before we do that, one last point on sort of one of the thematic issues of the book. And I was wondering your thoughts on, you know, with everything that's going on in the news now. I had the pleasure of living in New York for 6 months right after 9/11 in 2002. And you're right, it's a city that is so different to live in than any other place I've been in the world. And I was wondering your thoughts on whether you feel like terrorism and living there in the wake of 9/11 and living there now is sort of the great equalizer amongst the classes, and if you've found some sort of union amongst, you know, between the classes in sort of, I don't know, living with this sort of cloud over your head.
Well, I lived in New York in the late 90s. From 1996 onward was a stint in London. So I was there on September 11th and used to be able to see the trade towers from my window and was probably like around a mile away on that day and watched it all from my rooftop. And I did notice after that that very quickly class barriers broke down, that people talk to one another immediately. And a friend of mine recently, who's from Jamaica and who's been living in the South, talked about how in New York we backload the manners. So if we're on the street, you say, "Oh, where's 11th Street?" And someone will point to it, and you say, "Thanks." And if you're in the South, you say, "Excuse me, could you please tell me where 11th Street is?" And someone else will respond that way. But if you go to someone in the South and say, "Hey, where's 11th Street?" Mm-hmm. You don't get the same reaction. And one of the really nice things about being in New York when these moments of kind of class collapse and togetherness is that you feel like that strange urban intimacy is very earned. In the sense that no one is putting on a show of being polite to one another, but what they are showing is that they need each other. And I definitely felt that after 9/11. And the city, and in the larger context of, you know, of terrorism as a form of warfare practiced by stateless actors, I think it's often grouped under the idea that it comes from aliens. It comes from other people. But New York is a city of aliens. I mean, it's such a comically diverse city. I'm constantly on the subway, and I'm the only white person. I didn't seek out that environment, and eventually I stopped noticing it. So when you come into New York City, the boundary between sort of you and the other, if you want to, if that still holds, is not you and that brown guy sitting further down the car, you are that Middle Eastern guy. It's you and non-New Yorkers.
Right.
And I think that is still a slightly tribal thing, but to me it's a slightly more inclusive division than the one that sort of projects danger onto racial or ethnic groups based on their perceived similarity to former celebrity terrorists, if you will.
Right. That's a really great observation and way to look at it. I wish I could highlight all 30 of these essays because every one is more interesting. And, you know, there's poetry in here and there are sort of little vignettes. I can't remember what this woman calls them, but they're like little snippets of people's deaths. She has a great word for it, and I can't remember what it is. But
You're talking about Teju Cole's Small Fates.
Yes, Small Fates.
Yeah,
right.
Teju is such a wonderful writer. He's constantly sort of testing himself, and for a long time, he was very active on Twitter, and he basically was trying to use this small form to do what it did best. And he ended up taking little biographies of people from newspapers in the 1912-1913 year, and he basically takes them out of context and layers them one after another. And they all involved deaths. And that's, you know, you want to talk about the great equalizer. You know,
yeah.
New York after 9/11 was one thing, but obviously, sadly, we all die. And so just as an example, I'm picking this at random. Here's one. The journalist Dayton of West 21st Street, unable to find his glasses, took what looked to him like his medicine and is no more.
Right.
So there are all these sort of slightly comical and sometimes grim deaths, one after another after another. And New York is like all cities, has its dangers. But somehow this format is both inclusive because it highlights what happens to all of us, but it, by making us laugh, I think it reminds us that we're all kind of in this city in this boat together.
Yeah, it's a great form. I've never seen anybody do it like that. But I guess it's a little bit, a little reminiscent of the Humans of New York that that I love to follow, that you just take snapshots of people's lives and their photos, and you feel like you have this intimacy with someone, kind of, you know, unearned intimacy with someone when you get a little snapshot of their story. It's really wonderful.
Yeah, the best photographs feel that way.
Yeah.
And Teju does that in these little pieces. I mean, New York is such a fabulous city in that it's just, I'm looking out my window right now, for example, and there's people digging up the street to repair a power line. There's a German hotel across the street that's being built. There's about 20 guys working on it. There's a wig shop outside. There's some women standing outside. There's a luggage shop. There's a gym, which is open 24 hours, where I see the taxi drivers stop at 3 in the morning. The Pakistani guys get on the treadmill and walk for an hour. There's a karate kickboxing studio. There's a Chinese guy on a bicycle delivering food. There's about 6 cabs. I mean, and this is just one 40-yard stretch of a block, and it's happening constantly all the time. It's sort of like a tornado of human activity. And what I think, if you live in the city and you can keep that slightly at a distance in the sense of not try to keep up with it, which is what everyone does when they're young, it's a very hopeful-making place to live. And the reason why I put this book together is I believe in cities, and I believe in the idea of cities, which is that, you know, in proximity we're better than we are in isolation, which to me is also the definition of civilization, that we can live better together than we do apart. And I think one concept that really erodes that agreement with each other is if somehow someone else's pain doesn't matter to us, if someone else's circumstances are detached from us. And I think in the United States, we have real questions to ask ourselves about what we mean when we talk about freedom. I think often what we mean is liberty, you know, the ability to just do what we want, when we want, and where we want. And freedom is slightly different. It's what we, you know, the ability to do what we want within certain agreed upon sort of parameters. And city life depends utterly on those parameters. And I think civilization, this sort of larger idea, the idea that we're better together, utterly depends on kind of having active empathy most times.
Right.
And if you live in a city that teaches you to drown that out because you have to step over homeless people or you have to not notice people that have far less than you do, then I think it's very gradually unraveling that very core thread of what a city is about.
Right, right. I agree with you. I want to give you a little chance to talk about Freemans before we have to sign off. And sort of choosing the topics and putting the journal together, you were the former editor of Granta. So talk a little bit about what Freemans hopes to accomplish. And for people who aren't familiar with it at all, you can just kind of describe it for us.
Well, it's a paperback book with pieces by 22 writers. Some of them are short stories, some are essays, some are poems. And the theme of it is arrival. It's the first issue. But more largely, I thought, as a new journal, as a new kind of anthology of sorts, that why not begin at the beginning, that moment of arrival? We all have it when we arrive in a place, strange state of mind, or we arrive in the world as children, as babies. We all arrive at some point, and if we wake up in the morning, we have a series of arrivals to negotiate in a day. And so I thought it was a kind of democratic place to begin. And a couple of years ago, I had the feeling that writing wasn't about intelligence. Writing was about telling stories. And I realized that all my favorite writers were storytellers. That was their primary thrust in the world. It was not the projection of intelligence and smartness, although it's wonderful, and the uses of the mind are incredible. There's something magical which happens in storytelling, that perhaps storytelling is a higher faculty in some ways than reason. And so I wanted to get the best storytellers that I knew to write about a moment of arrival. And I didn't know that that's what I wanted them to do. I simply asked my favorite writers if they had something that they could contribute for this new issue, just to get into the boat on its first trip down the river to see if it floated. And they would be instrumental to whether it floated. So very early on, I was lucky. There was a Haruki Murakami story that I was allowed to grab for the journal, a wonderful story about an actor who basically discovers that every time he comes back from a role, he's slightly changed. His life is different. He's in a slightly different suit. And he's in a much different role, too, because he's a widower. And so it's a story about those two things kind of interacting. And Barry Lopez gave me a wonderful tip about a photographer who took a series of pictures about a road in Alaska that goes nowhere. Wow. And he wrote an essay to go with it about nature, about how we constantly have to create boundaries which don't maybe exist in the world, but exist in our mind, such as out there or nature and civilization. Wow. Louise Erdrich sent me a piece about going home to her native reservation, Turtle Mountain, and about how it's a place where, given the sort of cosmology of the Indian tribe that she's from, that death and living are connected things. It's not sort of a one-way door, if you will, and that spirits are around us. And so it gave a whole other meaning to arrival. And once I had those people in the mix, I'm sort of off and running, and I wanted to put together a book-length series of pieces that made you just constantly more awake and alert to those feelings of arrival. Because one of the, to me, the most accessible, constant pleasures in life is just the pleasures of mindfulness, of noticing, of being awake and alert to the possibilities of the world and what's happening around us. It's the best reality TV show ever created. And there's no one like writers who are the world's best noticers to make that feel possible.
Yeah, isn't that true? And it seems like the essay is sort of enjoying some sort of renaissance these days, that I feel like I see more essays. I don't know if it's, you know, an anecdote to all of the memoirs that were coming out, but what a great form. I think it's a wonderful way to get to writers in little short snippets and see their perspective of the world if you don't have time for the whole novel.
Yeah, I think the essay is basically a way a writer can show their mind at work. It shows the mind thinking, and wrestling with something. And writers have incredible minds, and usually they're busy dreaming. You know, that's what, to me, a novel is. It's sort of a written dream. Whereas I think the essay is somehow something even more fixed, you know, something that you can walk on, like a road. Yeah. And the craziest, and I say that in the broadest sense of the term, essay in this first issue of Freeman's is a 24,000-word essay by Lydia Davis, the short story writer, who writes very, very short stories normally about learning Norwegian without a dictionary by reading one of the most recent published difficult novels by Norway's most experimental novelist without a dictionary.
Wow.
And teaching herself Norwegian along the way. It's truly extraordinary. It's like watching someone walk a kind of linguistic tightrope. And she describes the way her mind is trying to puzzle out this language that seems so foreign, and using just the barest clues of German and French, which she had studied before. And it's, if you like Sudoku, if you like crosswords, if you like just watching a mind work at an intractable problem and then gradually beating it, it's sort of like a detective piece. There's actual tension in it.
Wow, that's amazing. Oh, we're out of time. But John Freeman, this was really incredible. We need more time
next
time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. That was John Freeman. He is the editor of Tales of Two Cities, The Best and Worst of Times in Today's New York. He's also the editor of the new anthology, Freeman's. You can find out more about him online. That's all the time we have for today. We will take next week off. I think we're doing a pre-recorded show, but we will be right back here with you after Thanksgiving. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.